time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 31st, 2019. I hope everyone who listens here in the States is having a safe and fun Labor Day weekend and riding instead of laboring. This week, we're going to speak with two incredibly interesting, fierce, and inspirational women. Lynn Salvo. Wow, where to begin? She's about to turn 70, and in the past couple of years, she's notched 2 Guinness World Records on her belt. She holds a PhD in mathematics, she speaks Italian, and she clearly loves riding long distances. We held up this interview an extra week so that the upload would coincide with the completion of one part of her current project, that of riding the shape of a peace sign around the entire United States. We'll talk about that, her world records, why she focuses her efforts on peace, and what her next projects will be in a moment. After our mid-show break, the inspiration just keeps on coming. Jamie Whitmore was an athlete from the time she was 5. Since then, she has, wait for it, 11 gold, 3 silver, 6 bronze UCI Paracycling Road World and UCI Paracycling Track World Championships. She's the gold medal winner of the road race from the summer 2016 Paralympics. She's also the silver medal winner of the 3,000-meter individual pursuit from the summer 2016 Paralympics. Best Female Athlete with a Disability ESPY Award was bestowed upon her in 2014, and she is the winningest female athlete in Xterra off-road triathlon history with 37 wins. She's also a member of the Xterra Hall of Fame. Back in 2008, she was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer, and after a lot of treatments, relapses, and finally recovery, she went back to racing as a paracyclist. Her journey is nothing less than amazing, and I can't wait to talk with her. So first, it's off to Nebraska, where Lynn Salvo was taking a day off from her current long-distance event. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane. I'm really thrilled to do this.
Well, I'm excited to talk with you. Where are you right now?
Right now, I am in the little town of Verdigris, Nebraska.
Verdigris, Nebraska. Okay, I'll bite. If I were looking at Nebraska, what would it be close to? I don't know much about Nebraska.
I didn't know much about Nebraska before either. It's pretty remote. It's kind of north. It's northeastern Nebraska. It's the part of Nebraska that was really hit by the flood in mid-March this year.
Oh, yeah. How's it doing up there?
We learned about the flooding. Actually, I was driving to Wichita the days that the flood was happening. I knew nothing about it. And even if I had known about it, I wouldn't have connected that it would affect my ride now. But what we're seeing is a fair amount of road work. And since I'm on a bicycle, I stop on bridges and I look over the sides to take pictures of them. And we've seen several bridges that have big trees lodged against them or just massive amounts of debris down by the water. And we have also had more than once we've been stopped at a bridge where one lane is open while they're repairing the other lane. So we just have to wait at a stoplight for a while.
Climate change. We don't need to talk about that, but it's clear that it's around us all the time, right?
It's very clear.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
So let's talk about the trip you're on right now. It is clearly not your first trip. Tell us about this particular trip, and then we're going to jump into some other stuff.
Okay. So this particular trip started in Wichita, which is the hub of the peace sign I'm trying to cycle. and we're going from Wichita to Manitoba, Canada, passing the border, crossing the border at the International Peace Garden, which just seemed terribly appropriate.
So it does.
Yeah. So the entire peace sign I finally calculated is over 14,000 miles, and I've ridden about 11,000, maybe 11,500 of them already.
Wow.
So this is the next to last piece of it. And the final piece will be the Pacific Coast. I'm kind of saving the awesome for last.
Yeah, when we give all the information at the end of our conversation as to how people can follow you, they'll be able to see a map of how you're cycling this peace sign of the country. And it's clear that that is going to be the last piece. It's the one that's not darkened in any way. And it is very pretty, although I have to tell you, driving the Pacific Coast Highway, no, I made my husband do that. I don't know. I don't know about riding it, let alone driving it.
I've had people tell me that it can be pretty terrifying on a bicycle. And I will be going north to south because that's the preferred direction
right.
because of wind.
Right.
And it also is preferred direction for the views.
It is. It is indeed. But that's also what makes it a little bit more terrifying because you're in that,
right.
that cliffside lane. So let's talk a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and what you did or do professionally.
I was born in Baltimore, and I grew up there until I went to college outside of Philadelphia. After that, I went to Italy, actually, to study art. I was there, ended up being there for 3 years. I met my husband there. And then we came back. I was a teacher for a while. We had two children, and I got into teaching math and then tutoring math. And then I started my own business doing summer math camps for children. It was called Math Tree. Then I sold that business in 2014. And that brings me to now, because pretty much the first thing I wanted to do once I sold the business was to ride my bicycle across the United States.
Well, there's a doctor in front of your name.
Yes.
And that would be?
Okay, that's a PhD in math education leadership. So let me go back to 1999. We were all waiting for the millennium change.
Right.
And I was waiting for, for my 50th birthday. So all of a sudden, I decided my life is not over just because I'm about to turn 50. So that year, I started a PhD, I started a business, and I started running, not cycling, but running. Because another thing that had been put off was to run a marathon. So when I was in college, one of my college classmates had placed 26th in the Boston Marathon. I thought, wow, I got to try that. So I got up to 8 miles, and then I was in Appalachia for spring break, and I saw trucks driving by with shotguns in the back, and I decided, no, I'm not going to train anymore, not here. So I dropped it, and then 32 years later, I finally ran, and my very first marathon, I qualified for the Boston Marathon by 3.6 seconds.
That's pretty close.
That was in 2002. I always think back to that last water stop that I did not stop at, because had I stopped, I wouldn't have made it.
How interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lynn Salvo. She is on the road. And what do you hear some of the things she's accomplished? Although it sounds like right up till now, you've accomplished a whole lot in your life. How old are your kids?
My daughter is 39. My son is 35.
Okay. And they're clearly off on their own at this point.
You bet.
Yeah, right. So I want you to go back in time a little bit and talk about this long-distance cycling Jones that you have and that you've been fulfilling for the last however many years. How and when did you decide to become or to begin long-distance cycling?
Well, it's really kind of funny. I did the two marathons because I did the one to qualify and then I did the Boston Marathon. And right after that, I started having running injuries. So my coaches were suggesting doing cross training. So I started cycling, and then somewhere somebody suggested doing triathlons. Well, I've only swum for, fun at the beach or whatever. So then I started swimming, and so I started doing triathlons. And for some reason, I guess my running was good enough that I was doing pretty well. So I was at first using an old beater bike that a friend of mine had given my daughter. It was just hanging around at our house. And then when I started doing well, I figured, well, I can do even better if I have a good bike. So I got a Trek. I got a Trek in, I think it was 2004. And I rode that until last year. So I had that bike for 13 years. It was a good little bike.
Good bikes last a long time. That is true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yep.
How cool is that? So there is a backstory to the work you're doing on a bike. And I'm going to call it work because you get up every day and do it, even though it's fun. And you actually are riding sort of in memory of your brother.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about
that. My brother was shot down in Vietnam in 1970. He was never found. So technically he's missing, although his wife elected to move on in her life. And so she had him declared dead and eventually remarried. But he had a child. She was pregnant when he went down. So the child was born, my nephew, John. And John never met his dad, and my brother never met his son. And that's always been a real point of sadness for me. And if I can do anything to prevent that happening to one family, even to one family, I would be satisfied, because it creates such a hole in a family. It's you can get past it, but it never really heals.
Sure, sure. So you've been cycling essentially for peace.
Yes. Not always, not from the very beginning. It evolved. Yeah, it evolved. My very first ride was Ride to Awareness. It was in 2015. So let's go back a little bit, if it's okay.
Sure.
In 2014, in the fall, I sold my business, and that's what freed me up to ride. And actually, let me go back another little teeny bit to June of 2014. I had my second rotator cuff surgery. And I remember the surgeon came in before he did the surgery, and he said, "Do you have any questions?" I said, "Yes. Will I be able to ride my bike across the United States?" And he said, "Yes, just not tomorrow morning."
Good answer, Doc. That's good. That's good. Reminds me of some old jokes, but that's really a good one. Really a good one. Okay. So how long did it take before you could get back on your bike and ride this cross-country trip?
So he said I needed to be off the bike for 3 months completely. So by the time that I sold my business, then I was somewhat free. I still had some things to wrap up in transferring the business to the new owners. But by the spring of 2015, I was feeling quite free. And so at that point, I was thinking of cycling across the U.S. in 2016. And I thought what I needed to do was to be able to ride 300 miles in a week. So the very week that I was going to hit 300 miles, I was in between two rides, one I'd done by myself and then one I was going to do with a group. And I received an email from a friend who said that a friend of hers was going to ride across the U.S. starting in September of 2015. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm at 300 miles right now. I'm ready. Let's do this. So in those 5 minutes between the rides, I applied. And then 2 days later, I had an interview. And one of the interview questions was, have you ever done a multi-day bike ride? And I said, no, what's that?
Yeah, it's baptism by fire, right? Get on the bike and ride.
Yeah. So I had heard, so he accepted me in spite of that. And then I heard later on, because, you know, I investigated who he was and what rides he'd done and so forth. And I'd read that there was a woman on his ride that he had fired on a previous ride. And I had to understand that. And my goal was to not be that woman. So I trained like crazy. On the very first day of the ride, I did hills. I did everything. I did distance. I had a wonderful, I still have a wonderful bike mechanic. who actually gave me really excellent coaching tips. And he said, just increase your mileage by 10% a week. Just gradually work your way up to where you're ready to do, 300, 350 in a week. The very first day of the ride, it started in San Diego, and the very first day of the ride had this monster climb.
Yep.
And I was in such trepidation. Everybody was younger than me. I had a good bike, so the bike wasn't a factor. But it turned out that most of the people on the ride really hadn't done that much training. So the very first day on the ride, I'm a good half a mile or a mile ahead of everybody. I said, yeehaw.
So who was this person who put this ride on?
His name is Alan Giese. And he's out of Florida.
Interesting. I guess it's just, I've never heard of it. But that's cool.
Yeah, it was just a one-time thing.
Okay.
He had a son with mental illness, and so he wanted to do this ride on behalf of his son.
So yep. That was sort of your introduction to this idea of long-distance cycling.
Correct. Now, let me go back. During the time that I was doing triathlons, which was about a 6 or 7 year period, I had learned about centuries. So I think I did my first century, I think was probably 2007. And then I did about one a year for a few years. So that was the longest I had done before I rode cross country for the first time.
All right. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Lynn Salvo. We're talking about how she got into these Guinness World Record bike rides. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll ask Lynn about how you go about getting a Guinness World Record. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Lynn Salvo. She's in Nebraska, completing a portion of her current project. She is the holder of 2 Guinness World Records, and we're going to talk to her now about how you go about getting a Guinness World Record. You actually have set 2 Guinness World Records. What are they? When did you do them?
So the first record was for the oldest female to bicycle across the United States. I did that in 2016. I turned 67 on that trip.
Wait, you turned how old?
67.
Holy, okay, go ahead. Somehow I thought it was younger than that, but okay, cool. And then?
Yep, and then last summer, 2018, I cycled across Canada. So oldest female to bicycle across Canada. So I turned, let me see, I was almost 69 when I finished that ride.
I was going to say, come on, it's 2 years. We can add 2 to So I guess I have a question about how the Guinness World Records work. How do they know you achieved it? And what were you? Okay, we were talking about being able to do 300 miles in a week. My guess is you're doing more than that these days.
Yeah, I can do more than that now.
Yeah. Okay.
So well, I've done 500 mile weeks.
Okay.
A few times.
Cool. So how do they know that you did this? And, well, clearly they understand who their record holders are and aren't.
Oh,
so,
yes.
Yeah. So how does it work? How does the Guinness World Record thing work?
It's actually a big deal. It's not an easy thing. Doing the documentation for the record was much harder than writing it. Yeah. So you actually have to apply to set a record before you go about doing it. So it's not an after the fact. You have to do it beforehand. So in fact, when I did that very first ride in 2015, I kind of looked around me and I thought, I know people younger than me that have done this, who are, in their 60s who have done this, but I don't know anyone who's older than me that's ridden across the United States. So I actually applied to set the record, or I looked up the record. And then I didn't find one, so then I applied before I set off on the very first ride in 2015. And I heard back from Guinness about halfway through that ride. I remember it was October, and I was sitting in their RV support van, And I get this email from Guinness and says, well, if you'll do the ride next year again, you can set a record because we have somebody who did it at 66. So I just chuckled that, like, I'm going to do this ride again. Sure. And then by the end of the ride, I had such a good time on it. Somehow it just really fit my mind and my body. And it's, everything about it was so delightful that by the time I got home in, or I guess it was early November, I thought, well, let me look into this. So I think it was late December, I wrote back to them and I said, well, you know, tell me about the record that you have. So they sent me a link to it, and it was to a woman who had ridden across the country at age 66 on the Race Across America in a relay team.
Uh-huh.
So they had totally messed up. There was no comparison.
Right, exactly.
So when I so when I pointed that out to them, they said, oh, well, then our record is age 52. So
you're saying, well, I think I set the record this year.
Yeah, so, and it's not that nobody older than 52 had done it, but I guess it was the documentation that wasn't in place, because I know that older people have, older women have done it.
Hmm.
So anyway, to go back, so once you apply to set a record, first they have to approve it, and it can take a very, very long time. It took them 11 months to approve my application to cycle across Canada.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I had already kind of planned it in hopes that they would approve it, but it, when it finally came through, then it was all gung-ho. Then to document it, you have to, of course, you have your bike files. And I think that's the main thing that they look at. But then you have to have witnesses. You know, I tried to get two witnesses a day. So you go up to total strangers with this form that takes at least 5 minutes to fill out, a lot of fields to fill out. And you explain what you're doing. And in the process of doing that, you end up meeting all these strangers. So at first, I found it really off-putting. But then I realized, wait a minute, I'm meeting all these really cool people.
Right.
So I remember being in a very remote place. I think it was in Arizona. I mean, I was 35 miles in either direction from anything. And I go up to this young couple and I start, you know, explaining what I'm trying to do and ask if they'd be a witness. And then the woman turns around and talks to the man in Italian. Well, I speak Italian, so I understood everything. And then we got into an entire conversation. And this young couple was on their honeymoon from, they were from Florence, Italy, and they were on their honeymoon in Arizona.
How cool is that? You probably yeah. gave them a story, right?
Yeah, right. So that's how seeking witnesses turned out to be. It was just a wonderful opportunity to meet people. So I've talked about bike records, and I talked about witnesses. You have to keep a log every day, every time you stop to pee or eat or take a photo. So detailed logs. I know there are other things. They're not coming to mind right now, but if I think of them, I'll add it.
Well, then, that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Ten minutes a day of video of yourself on the bike. That is hard because for that, I needed a SAG. So I had a SAG support on both record rides. And to get footage, if they were stopped, they could get 30 seconds of me arriving and 30 seconds of me leaving. And so we had to repeat that over and over. And then what we ended up doing was we did a little video at the beginning and end of each day that would preview and, you know, and a review. And that gave us a couple of minutes. And then on the Canada ride, they made the restrictions even worse, and they said the SAG always had to be behind me. So that was even tougher.
Oh, because it was, it had to go much slower. It couldn't leapfrog ahead of you. I see. Oh,
that's right. Hmm. Yeah, no leapfrog support. So that made it even tougher to get the footage. So, but we did it. So video footage, photographic evidence, media coverage. Those were the kinds of things that you had to send. And then once you send it in, you can wait as long as 3 months to find out if you set a record.
And once you set a record, they send you what? What do you get anything specific for that?
A certificate.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, the first time, though, the first record was really kind of fun because they invited me for an interview in their studio in New York. But I did not know whether I had the record yet or not.
Interesting.
So on the other hand, I figured they're not going to really invite me to, you know, to be in the studio and say, no, you didn't get the record. So they actually presented me with the certificate during the interview, and it's on Facebook Live. It's really fun to watch.
I've watched several of your YouTube videos, and they are fun. You do have fun. I can see that, which is really cool that you're having so much fun.
I am. In fact, after my first ride, I actually went to my doctor, and I said, why do I love this so much? Why is this so much fun for me? And she said, you're creating monster amounts of endorphins all day long.
Right, exactly. And you probably sleep well at night too, right?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm just too excited about what's coming next or too nervous about what's coming next. There's almost always some crux on the ride. My son is a rock climber, and in rock climbing, there's usually a crux. You know, some part of the climb that's especially challenging. And for me, most rides have some part of the day that's extra challenging. And sometimes that keeps me awake.
Yeah, I did watch the one video where you were talking about making this descent and the sort of at the beginning going, I don't know if I want to do this. But once you were on your way, you were on your way. So, yeah, I do understand what you're saying. Absolutely. I think all of us who ride like that are going, well, what's today going to be like? You know, we're supposed to do this monster climb. I don't know if I'm ready for that. So you talk about having on-the-road support. You usually stay in hotels, motels, B&Bs. What do you do?
Yes, that and also warm showers whenever I can.
Okay.
But this ride that I'm currently on is a really big leap because my friend Brenda, who is from Wichita, she's cycled more of the peace sign than anyone else with me. She really kind of wanted to try a long self-supported ride. So this is a 3-week self-supported ride, not self-contained. So we're not camping and we're eating out, but we're carrying our own stuff the whole way.
Nice.
And there's some trepidation. The longest I had done before this was 8 days, and that was in June.
And when will this part of it be done? When will you finish up this part of the peace sign and then head home until the Pacific side?
Right. This is the northern spoke of the peace sign. And the way we have it planned out, we expect to finish about August 31st. I don't have my plane ticket home yet. We did that so that we could keep it loose and we wouldn't have to stick to a schedule in case we got any terrible weather. The irony is that today was our first planned rest day, and it turns out we are heading north constantly on this trip, and today was a headwind. It would have been a headwind day, so it just worked out perfectly.
Yeah, you're in Nebraska, we're here in Ohio. We had one just horrific storm overnight. It was just insane. It looked like a hurricane when you looked outside. So I imagine you guys sent it our way, all that wind. But I understand that if you're taking the day off, it's probably a good day to do that. There are two other things I want to talk about. One is there's a fundraising aspect of your ride. Who are you raising funds for and what is the organization?
Right. So I'm raising funds for the American Friends Service Committee. It's a long-standing organization that has been working for peace for, I want to say, over 100 years. They do conflict resolution and prevention. They do activities to prevent peace. And they're really good at it and really, they just know how to do it because they've been doing it for so long. And they're very quiet about it.
And then the last thing I want to talk about is if somebody wanted to emulate what you're doing, a woman riding solo, what kind of advice might you give someone who would say, I want to follow in Lynn's footsteps or in Lynn's pedal strokes?
One thing is you can do so much more and so much longer than you think you can. That's one thing. Another is if you need help, ask for it. I was on a ride with a friend in July, and we had a flat kind of in the middle of nowhere. And we asked them, a car that went by, or one of the very few cars that went by, where the nearest place was to get water, because it was a really hot day. We're running a little bit low. And she reached in her car and pulled out two bottles of water and gave them to us.
Yeah, of course.
So there's lots of kindness out there available. People, my experience is that drivers make as much room as they possibly can for you on the road. It's very rare for people to kind of skim close to you. Extremely rare. I absolutely urge anyone to use a rear view mirror. I almost won't cycle with anybody who doesn't have one because it's too nerve-wracking. Be worried about them.
All right. So the last thing I want to know is, how can my listeners follow you? Where are they? Because your blog is fun. I want you to tell them the address of the blog. And you seem to make entries pretty much every day.
It's called Life is Like a Bike. That's all one word. Life is Like a Bike. .wordpress.com. And I really love the blog part of it. I've always blogged on the long distance rides, and it's one of the most fun aspects for me. I think about it kind of all day long, but I definitely let the theme emerge from the day's ride. I don't usually go into a ride with a preconceived notion of what the blog is going to be about. So it's really kind of an in-the-moment thing, and it's really a major part of my ride.
Well, it is a fun blog, lifeislikeabike.wordpress.com. We've been speaking with Lynn Salvo. She is on her way to completing a peace sign by riding it across and around the United States. I hope you have lots of luck and a good trip back home. Until when will you start your Pacific last part of your peace sign, the west side of it?
So I'm glad you asked that.
Okay.
You would think I'd want to just get that done, right?
Maybe.
So I do, except that I have one more huge goal before that. And that is that next year I'm going to attempt to set the Guinness record for the oldest female to bicycle across Europe from Norway to Spain.
Wow.
And because those two things have to happen I definitely don't want to do both of those in the same year.
Right, right, sure.
So, and they both are kind of the same season. So my goal for 2020 is to cycle across Europe. And then on September 6th of 2021, I hope to begin the Pacific Coast from the Peace Arch. It's near Vancouver in Canada. And the reason for that date is that is the 100th anniversary of the Peace Arch. Of the completion of the
Well, you just search. Have it all figured out, Lynn. That's so cool.
I have the plans. I just have to stay healthy. My husband has to stay healthy. My mom has to stay healthy.
There you go. Well, and it seems like things just fall into place. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Have a safe trip back home, and we'll watch for your European trip. We will post your blog on our Facebook page, and thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Diane. I really enjoyed speaking with you. It was really fun.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Lynn Salvo joined me from on the road in Nebraska. Actually, she wasn't on the road that day. She was resting. But as of today, August 31st, Lynn is in North Dakota completing the second-to-last portion of her peace sign in honor of her brother, who is still considered MIA in Vietnam. If you'd like to know more about Lynn and follow her journeys, you can log on to lifeislikeabike.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll meet the force that is Jamie Whitmore. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Jamie Whitmore is the most successful female athlete in Xterra history, with 37 wins, 6 national titles, and 1 world title. I think it might be more than 1 world title, actually. We'll ask her. Overcoming some unbelievable adversity, Jamie has gone on to win gold and silver in Rio in 2016, is raising twin boys, and still competes at world-class level. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show and for being my guest this week.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to go back in time. You have an amazing story to talk to me about today, and I want to talk about how you got into cycling, but you really didn't start there. You started like as a five-year-old athlete. What did you do at that age?
Oh, I started swimming. My older sister by about 5.5 years was on the swim team. And of course, when you have an older sister, you always want to be just like her. So that's when I learned how to swim. I think it was about 4.5 and joined the swim team by the time I was 5.5.
Nice. And from there, you went on to track and field?
Yes. So in eighth grade, I got talked into running track and field by a friend. So that by the time I went to high school, you know, during the spring sports, you have a choice between swimming, running, and softball. And I could have done either one of them. And my math teacher at the time was the head coach. And he just kept kindly telling me I needed to go out for the track team. So he ended up winning. And that's what I did.
And you had some success there, I take it?
I did. I was one of the top athletes in definitely in our district and then subsections and even sections qualifying for state every year that I did cross country. And that earned me a scholarship to Cal State Northridge, where I ran for the 4 years that I was there.
I read in an interview that you did become competitive as a child, and you thought that your dad never let you or your siblings win. Is that true? You wanted to beat him?
Oh, yeah. No, so growing up, my family was on my dad's side, was very active in board games. And I mean, you name it, cards, thumb wars, kick the can, badminton, like we always played. And I didn't have any cousins. So it was always my uncles, my aunt, my dad, and then my grandparents and my sister. And so my dad was just relentless and ruthless. It was like he always wanted to win, even in thumb war, where his thumb is like twice the size of mine. One, two, three, four, I declare a thumb war. And every time he would just smash my thumb down. And it was like a happy dance when he won.
Even though he knew he was going to win. I mean, how fair is that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, right.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me about your early bike racing days. You were, again, relentless, just like he was, evidently.
Yeah. So out of high school or out of college, I toured Europe, came back, and decided to be a triathlete. I think it was about maybe a year after that, I started picking up mountain biking, and I had some great training partners, and we just always would ride. And so I think within a year span, I became a full-fledged professional mountain biker. And then it wasn't long after that that I discovered Xterra, which is off-road triathlons, and then that launched my big-time career as a pro.
Which you have a ton of national and world titles in Xterra. You were actually, I think, didn't you win an ESPY?
So that's later.
Okay, so,
yeah,
so we'll get to that.
My span of 7 years of being a pro mountain biker, because I went back and forth, but Xterra was always my focus because it paid better, and I loved it. It was my passion. It was my lifestyle. So I won 37 championships. And six U.S. championships, a world title, and two European tour titles. And even to the day that I was no longer able to race, I held that record over men and women, the 37 victories, for at least another 3 years, where Conrad Stoltz finally broke my record. But to this day, no female has broken that record.
That a girl. We love that. All right. Let me tell my listeners, we're speaking with Jamie Whitmore. We're talking about what happened up to about 2008 so far. I think that's where we are, yes?
Correct.
Okay.
So the tail end of 2007, I started having leg pain at the World Championships, so I stopped training for a month. And then when I began training, I couldn't run. The pain was very significant. I could still bike and swim. By 2008, I want to say the end of January, I was beginning to be kept up at night, unable to sleep because the pain was so severe in my kind of glute area hamstring. And then by February 7th, I had gone on my last bike ride because about 15 minutes out, the pain was just so excruciating. I began crying and turned around and came back. And that's when I went from hospital to hospital, doctor to doctor, got misdiagnosis after misdiagnosis, and it took us at least a good month until I found myself in San Francisco at UCSF, where you know, the doctors did some more poking and prodding and discovered indeed what had been causing all the pain.
And that was?
And that was a grapefruit-sized tumor growing right out of my sciatic nerve.
This is a stupid question maybe, but how the hell does somebody miss a grapefruit-sized tumor for a month?
So I'm about 115 pounds and I'm very tiny. And the way that that tumor was growing, it was actually growing through the hole in your pelvic bone. You know how you have two holes?
Yep, I do.
Yeah. So it was growing from the back and it was growing through to the front, and it was so large and it was pushing up against all kinds of, you know, vital organs like my rectum, my ovary, large intestine, my stomach. Like, it was just so smashed in there because I'm so tiny that when they would scan it from the front, it just looked like something that was maybe on my ovary. And then when you kind of scanned it from the back, it was very easy to miss because the MRI was too high or too low. Also because of where the pain was manifesting. It wasn't exactly right where it was growing. It was further down because the blood supply was being cut off. So it was just a combination of a lot of like things that caused no one to be able to figure out what it was. And every time they cut me open, the tumor was encompassed with a ton of blood vessels, which made it even harder for them to get a sample or to truly diagnose. In fact, they did not know it was a nerve tumor until they cut me open. They only knew that it was a spindle cell sarcoma, which meant it could have been growing from any soft tissue, bone, you know, organ, muscle in my body, because that's where sarcomas grow.
Wow.
You know, and I feel like I ended up in the right place, because many, many people before that were like, well, you should just cut off your leg. And, you know, they didn't want to deal with it because it was posing to be a very complicated thing. So at UCSF, they had a team of doctors that were like, we're going to figure this out. And they did an amazing job.
I know that they did something that now keeps you from competing, say, in the regular Olympics, and you've moved to the Paralympics, paracycling, which is no less impressive. But you did have some complications along the way. What happened?
So when they tested my nerve, the tumor had already choked it off and cut off the blood supply. So I was already exhibiting what's called drop foot, which is it's a paralysis of the lower part of your leg. So when they went in, they had to cut a section of my sciatic nerve, which left me with almost most of my leg being paralyzed. I have full use of my inner quad and straight up and down, but like the outer part of my quad doesn't work. I have no glute, no hamstring, and nothing below my knee works, nor can I feel it. So it's a condition called basically complete drop foot. So I am lucky that I can bend my knee, because on paper, I shouldn't even be able to do that, because you need hamstring, you know, a hamstring to kind of pull up your leg.
And yet, guess who cycles?
Exactly. And that's a funny thing, because when the doctor did remove the nerve, he had informed, you know, all 11 or 14 people that were in the waiting room there for me that I was going to walk with a limp or walk funny, whatever his words were, because I wasn't there for the rest of my life, and that I would never be able to run again. My pro career as a triathlete was done. The nerve doctor also told me in a meeting that I'd probably never ride anything more than a stationary bike.
And did we prove them wrong or what?
Exactly. It only took 3 years, but.
Well, but clearly Jamie was determined to get back on a bike. So there were some complications. You did have to go back in a couple of times. You had a relapse?
Oh, yeah. Well, first I had the tumor grew back. It was more aggressive than they thought. And so I had to go in for another surgery, and that's when they took all of my glute muscle, the rest of the nerve. And then from that surgery, I ended up getting sepsis because my kidney could no longer drain from my bladder, and that almost killed me. So there was about a 5-month span of trying to get me healthy to be able to do chemo. But then it took so long to get me healthy that I passed the first cancer scan, then I passed the second one. And then I just had the drain coming out of my kidney. So they removed that in 2009. And 3 weeks after that, I fell ill again. But this time it was because I was pregnant with twins.
And they are boys. Are they identical?
No, they are fraternal, and that's a wild story in of itself. But I pretty much, when I found out I was pregnant, threw my hands in the air and was like, okay, God, when you're ready to let me ride again, just let me know. I'm ready. But right now, I'm going to focus on this. So, yeah, there were some complications from that landed me in the hospital for 7.5 weeks until they were born. And then the first year of their life, I don't remember much. I just, no sleep. I barely showered. I probably barely ate. And when they were a year old, we found a brace, an AFO, which is an ankle foot orthotic, that was stiff enough that would allow me to be able to pedal a bike and fit inside a bike shoe, because I have to be clipped in on that side. I can't just do like the old days where you throw your feet on a pedal and start pedaling away.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jamie Whitmore. It's an unbelievable story. We're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, we're going to move on to what's happened since these boys were born and she got back on a bike. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Okay, we're back. We're speaking with Jamie Whitmore. She is a world champion, national champion, gold medalist, silver medalist, track, road, you name it. She's been there. We were talking about your twins being born and that you spent a year of like not remembering anything. And then you did get back on a bike. Tell us about this device, this orthotic that they made for you. Or I guess it exists for other people too, but it probably has to be custom fitted.
Well, it's interesting because, yes, my AFO, which is the ankle foot orthotic by Allard, is available to anyone that can get it. And they have ones that are really, really stiff, and then they have ones that are a little more flimsy for walking. Like, I can't walk in my bike brace, and I can't bike in my walking brace because I'll break it. I have to modify it myself to fit into my bike shoe, but as a whole, other teammates are able to use it as is, and they fit it right into their shoe and they can pedal.
Wow. A shareable brace. How cool is that? And you mentioned teammates. Let's talk about that. So you transitioned clearly from the Xterra kind of racing on with regular full-bodied athletes to this paracycling. How did you discover that and get into that?
So I always knew about the Paralympics from the Challenged Athletes Foundation, and it was because a handful of them used to come and race Xterra, and we always raised money in the Paul Mitchell Cutathons. And also one of the three co-founders, Bob Babbitt, I'd known him just through the whole triathlon world. Like, he's the guru of it. And so when word had been spread out or told to the world that I had a disability and wasn't going to return to triathlon, he called and said, Jamie, don't forget there's the Paralympics. So it was one of those where that Paralympic dream like started right then and there. And I knew in order to be riding a bike one day, I had to figure out how to walk. Cause that was the other thing. I had to learn to walk again. And it started with just getting off my bed and getting to the door and then getting to the nurse's station and then walking around. And I walked on a walker for quite a while. And then I had a cane for quite a while. And it was just such a slow, long process, but I knew I had to make those gains in order to one day get back on a bike.
And how long did that take?
Just to be able to walk outside my room took a week. And then when I got home, everything was a competition. So I'd time myself and I'd walk a half a mile and then I'd walk a mile and then I'd try to be faster each time. And I mean, I had nothing else to do other than take care of myself. So I had all day to just kind of really work on my physical therapy. I had two people that worked with me almost every single day. So I was seeing a physical therapist every day. And then I would swim and I would lift weights. So I was being active as best I could.
I think you're probably more active. You were more active then than most people are now. So most able.
Probably true.
That's true. So obviously you come from the nothing's going to stop me department. Tell us about how you ended up in Rio at the Olympics and winning gold and I guess silver.
A few people who knew me also knew coaches in the Paralympic cycling world. And so they kept reaching out to them and told them, hey, you need to contact this gal, Jamie, and get her to one of your events, get her classified. And so they did, and it took a while, which cracks me up, because it's like, if I was a coach, I would be jumping on that right away.
Right.
What? This person used to race bikes. Now they have a disability. You know, come join us. I ended up going to my first event. It was the year of London. I got to really focus in on what the Paralympics was all about. And it was a year that they did such a great job televising it. That really is where it began. And then 2013, I hit the road with the national team, made the A team. Then at the end of that year, learned to ride a track bike. And then in 2014, I started racing on the track as well, which is the velodrome. And that's when I set 2 world records. I won all 4 world championships that year, 2 on the road, 2 on the track. And that's when I was nominated for the ESPY and ended up winning for best female athlete with a disability.
I don't know, Jamie, you just don't have enough to do. You clearly do not have enough to do.
All the while being a mom too, which really hard.
Exactly. I take it you are still training. What's on your radar coming up? I mean, you've already achieved damn near everything. What's next?
You know, it's one of those where I've done everything I set out to do, and now it's kind of enjoying the ride, enjoying where I'm at, focusing mainly on being, you know, the best mom I can be while providing for my family, because I am a single mom. And so I'm still traveling with the team, and I'll keep racing as long as I can, because I have such a passion for traveling the world and just being competitive. So in 2 weeks, I will head to the Netherlands. And I will race in the world championships. And we're just about a year out from Tokyo, which is my next goal. I'd like to go back. And now that they've equalized the medal payout for both Olympian and Paralympians, a third place medal will pay more than both my gold and silver.
No kidding.
I know. So I'm determined to go back and bring home some more hardware, just because it will pay a lot of bills.
There you go. Let me ask you a question that is sort of opinion, but what would you tell somebody who's facing a situation like yours, who is an active person, finds himself or herself, you know, either with a disability or an illness or whatever, that ends up, they can't do what they used to do. What would you say to inspire him or her to be his or her best self?
Well, and it's kind of a two-part answer. The first is, you can never let somebody else dictate where you're going to go and what you're going to do, because no matter what, we're all different people and we're all going to be able to do what it is that we want to do. And the second part is, we have to find our own way to that end result. So me training and leading up to Rio didn't look like what it looked like when I was an able-bodied athlete. It was far different. I was a parent now, and I needed to keep a lot of that in mind. But it's one of those, like, I tell my kids this all the time, if you truly want something, you cannot settle for less, and you have to just keep finding a way to do it and surround yourself with people that are going to, like, come alongside you and get you there. I can remember firing, like, 2 of my doctors, and one of them was this urologist who was like coming up with these like terrible plans to deal with my kidney. And I didn't like anything she had. They were all quality of life type things. I want to be active, and everything she was doing, there's potential I wouldn't be able to be as active. So I fired her and found a new urologist that came up with a great plan to auto transplant my kidney. And it was the same with when I delivered the kids. I didn't like how my OB was, you know, had a plan. And I'm like, this doesn't work. You're not even paying attention to what's wrong with me. When it's time to deliver, how are you going to deliver 2 kids when I got a kidney here and I've already been cut open a million times? And so I found someone that was willing to, like, truly hear my story and come alongside me. And not to mention, like, all my friends and family, my dad, who have constantly been there supporting my dream and cheering me on.
Having that kind of support makes all the difference. But it's really interesting that you're talking about this medical sort of dilemma that people have, that they don't speak up for themselves and leave it up to somebody who doesn't really know them. And then they're sorry with the results, and it's like, well, it was their fault. You know, so not taking responsibility, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right. You have to always be your own advocate. In fact, I had the nerve doctor like, yeah, you're never going to get on a bike again. And I'm like, oh, I'll show you.
Right.
You know, and it's being realistic. Like, I knew, okay, my disability will not allow me to run. Like, that's legit. That's a fact. There's nothing out there that exists that will help me run. Okay. I get that. But then I look at, well, what can I do? And so I think it's more of stop looking at what you can't do and start looking at what you can do, I think was also helped me along the way.
Wow, what a great conversation this is. I'm really enjoying it. And unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it. But I have three questions for you. Are you ready?
Yes.
What's your favorite?
I am.
What's your favorite food?
It's Mexican food. And I want to put a spin on that Mexicali food.
How is that different?
Well, I think it's just a little bit the spices. It's just that California flair because it's different than, you know, Texas Mexican food.
Yeah, or, okay, I get it.
You know, Arizona, so that Mexicali food.
Within the Mexicali cuisine, what specific food do you like best? Everybody says tacos.
Oh, I do love street tacos, and I also love a very good burrito.
Okay. Do you listen to music when you train?
I do.
What do you listen to?
Anything that's like 50s all the way up to the 90s. A whole plethora of, like, you know, I love some Eminem. I love Queen.
Yes.
But then I also love the Beatles and the Who. And Hootie and the Blowfish. I mean, who doesn't love Hootie and the Blowfish?
I don't know. I haven't met anybody yet quite like that. So do you have any pets, you and the boys?
We do. We have a bearded dragon that we've had for 3 months now. His name is Spike. We inherited him from a friend, and I call him the dragon.
I love amphibians and reptiles. I think that's awesome. A bearded dragon. They're so cool. Now, do you keep him in like a big aquarium?
Yes, he's a big aquarium. We let him out to you know, crawl on us. We let him roam around, and then we clean up after him. And the people who had him before made him lazy because they fed him from a stick. So that's the only thing, is he's kind of high maintenance. We always have to put all the food on a stick so that he'll eat it.
Yeah, but have you ever met an animal that would starve itself given the opportunity? So maybe you could get...
Let me tell you, this guy did not eat for a week and a half because that was the attitude I took. And then I'm looking at this poor, you know, I'm looking at this poor bearded dragon, and I'm like, all right, I'm caving here. I'm putting your food on my stick.
I got it. Well, this has just been so much fun. Thank you so much for talking with me. How can people follow what you're doing? Do you have your own website, or do you want them to use Team USA?
You know, if you're social media, I am on Facebook and I'm on Instagram. Those are the two that I use the most. Okay. And I do have a website, but it's down right now and I'm working on it. But you can find me at Gutsy Try Girl or Jamie Whitmore.
All right. So. Well, I wish you lots of luck. I guess we have an Olympics coming up, what, next year?
Yep, a year from now is the Paralympics.
And you're aiming for gold. Bring home the gold,
I
honey.
Am.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful year of training, and we'll be watching the Olympics, and I'll post your Instagram and your Facebook on our Facebook.
Thank you.
All right. You take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jamie Whitmore joined me from her home in Northern California. If you're interested in learning more about Jamie or want to follow her amazing journey, you can find her on Facebook and Instagram at Gutsy Try Girl. That's GUTZYTRIGIRL. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. My thanks to both Jamie and Lynn Salvo for sharing their stories with us. We will be back next week with a brand new show, including the chat I promised this past week with Coach Chris Carmichael, who will get us back on the bike after a crash. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page, send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our OutspokenCyclist.com blog. Please leave a hopefully positive review on your favorite podcast app, too. We wish you a very happy and safe Labor Day holiday, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.